As troubling as a medical error is for patients and families, it is no comfort to anyone when the healthcare providers involved are unsupported and left to fend for themselves. The emotional damage that can result represents a second wave of injury that healthcare organizations trying to bend the curve on reliability and safety can't afford for their patients or their staff or their institution. We're talking about second victims on this edition of WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan, IHI's Director of Communications and the host and producer of WIHI. Thank you all for joining the discussion today. We have an expert group of guests, and we look forward to blending their knowledge with your own as we shed further light on best ways to learn from mistakes and adverse events, also bad outcomes with staff as well as patients, rather than turn the other way. If this is your first WIHI, we're thrilled to have you on board. WIHI is IHI's free audio talk show we launched last May. And with your tremendous response to the program, we're discovering the magic and power of a regular online forum to think out loud together about improvement and how to spread change and best practices. Have Dr. Wu to thank for attaching a doctor or nurse's face or some other staff member's face to this issue we're talking about today and coining the phrase the second victim. He did that in an essay in the British Medical Journal in 2000. Welcome, Dr. Wu.
Hello, Madge. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Wonderful. Coming through loud and clear. Wonderful. Now, all the way from Missouri, I think you can say it that way, Susan Scott is with us today. She's the Patient Safety Officer for University of Missouri, Missouri Healthcare in Columbia, Missouri. She's been working hard on developing institutional responses for staff following adverse events, and that earned her recognition in the form of the HOPE Award from MITS in 2009. So welcome, Susan.
Hi, Ken. Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Terrific. And in the studio with me, because we're neighbors, we're friends, we're colleagues, is the head of MITS, and that stands for Medically Induced Trauma Support Services, and that's Linda Kenny, perhaps familiar to many of you. Linda's compassion for patients and staff alike affected by medical errors and bad outcomes is unequaled, and that's born of direct experience and now leadership on these issues of support and healing, leadership that's recognized around the globe. So welcome, Linda.
Hi, Madge. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is great. And Linda has a beautiful jacket on today. I feel like it's kind of getting us into the Valentine's Day mood. So I feel so lucky to have corralled these three individuals about whom you can read more on IHI.org. And they, like me, are gratified by the attendance we're drawing for this discussion. So here's what I want to do. Some of you who are regulars on WIHI, I think we have a few of those out there, know that I like to sometimes start off with a couple of chat questions just to get everybody kind of away from your email and tuned in. And let's just see sort of who's out there and what's your experience. And then we'll close off chat after that and get back to your questions. But here's my first question to all of you. Jesse explained there is that hand button, which is the sort of raise your hand. So I would like you to raise your hand if you or someone you know was directly or indirectly affected as a health professional or staff member by a medical error or unanticipated outcome. Go ahead and join in. Okay. Let's see who we got. Everybody's up there. All right. So let's see. Numbers are still coming. Up to about 180, 190, almost 200. Whoops, keeps going. Okay, we have over 600 of you at least logged on through the computer, and the number is so far, it keeps, well, it's climbing at about 228, 230 of you have said yes. So that's about a third of you who've joined today. Thank you very much. All right, now another opportunity here to raise your hand. You can go ahead and take that down. Raise your hand if you felt the organization you work with for responded well to those who needed support. All right, let's see how we're doing here. 40, 45, okay, getting up there. All right, 70 climbing. For those of you on the phone, I'm looking at a screen on the computer that just gives me some idea of kind of who's on. All right, so just hovering about 100. About 100 of you said the organization responded well. So my final question, if you felt the support was deficient or non-existent, I'd like you to just chat in now, not so much the hand, but just give me a kind of one-word or two-word answer. What do you think stood in the way? Why don't you think the support was there? What do you think is one of the big barriers there? Go ahead and let's see what people have to say. Somebody raised their hand. Anybody got some idea about barriers, or have I asked a tough question there? Fear. Somebody says fear. Jamie Brooks. Thank you, Jamie. Don't be afraid. Denial. All right. This is going to help our guests. Anyone else? What do you think stood in the way? I've got hands raised. Scapegoat. Ignorance of the second victim concept. Well, hopefully we can address some of that today. Was fired. Lack of staff. Lack of staff. Okay. Kathy. Bureaucracy. All right. Rules. I was an employee. Human nature. It's all in there. Okay. Position arrogance, lack of manager's commitment, hierarchical culture. Okay. Afraid that there will be punitive responses. All right. Well, that's leadership, all of the above. All right. That's part of what we're trying to address today. So thank you very much, all of you. And we'll get back to some of these things, and we'll keep track. A reminder that you can download the chat at the end of the program, and then you yourselves can hold on to this embarrassment. Also very, very important. So here's what I'd like to do. As Jesse mentioned, we've got chat open now. We're going to sort of close it off for a little while so we can keep track, not get too distracted by what's in the window there. And then we'll be back and open it up again. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Wu, and reaction to what you saw there. You wrote your essay in 2000. Does this surprise you to see some of the responses there?
Well, I think this is more or less exactly what I have experienced throughout my career. And while there may have been some improvement since then, I would say it's more of the same.
All right. So now I need to know, what prompted you to write an essay in the British Medical Journal in 2000 and to be thinking about this notion of a second victim? Why did that seem like such an apt phrase for you?
Well, I'd had personal experience, as has almost every practicing clinician, with either making mistakes myself or seeing how other people were handled. And there was one instance while I was training in which someone made a mistake, which perhaps he shouldn't have, but he was immediately labeled as being incompetent. And there was just a firestorm of gossip, which was both uncomfortable but also pretty malicious. And I thought, gosh, could that have been me? Mm-hmm. And I realized, of course, that it could have been. It's simply that it wasn't me that was being discussed at that particular moment. And it seemed like we were not handling our errors in a healthy way. And in a way that would allow us to learn from mistakes.
How close do you need to be to the event to be affected, to sort of fall into this space here of being a second victim or being injured as well?
Well, I think that this is, in a way, a form, in some ways, very closely related to PTSD. Mm-hmm. And certainly, at the moment that something goes wrong, if you happen to be aware of what has happened, you can be immediately traumatized. You can have a terrific, horrible emotional response. But years later, these things can return to haunt you when you may have suppressed them for years. Interestingly, when you asked me that question, and when I wrote that article, I wrote about my observation of another medical resident. But thinking back, I can remember now an instance when I was a medical student taking care of one of my very first patients, and the patient had a code, and I was told I was participating, sort of swept up in the incident, and I was asked to give a medicine, morphine, and I squirted a syringe of morphine into an IV, and it was more than was intended. And the person became very, very sedated and fortunately did not have permanent harm, but I was but needed to be intubated, and I was completely shocked and stunned and felt horrible. But afterwards, a senior person said, "You know, well, after discussing it, you know, I don't think anyone needs to know about this." And I was left thinking, feeling relieved, but also feeling that it was not handled well.
Right. Interesting. Oh, boy. Well, that's going to be a nice pave way to Linda Kenny here. I guess one very quick follow-up. Is there much research that is able to sort of capture some of these issues about when you say PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? Is there much research about sort of longer-term kind of consequences of what we're talking about?
So, you know, there is very, very little research. I think that this has not been studied systematically. The long-term impact has simply not been studied, though there are plenty of anecdotes and mostly essays and personal reflections. The funny thing is that if you – I think all of us have spoken about this topic, and what always happens is that immediately after you speak, someone comes up to you and says, "Let me tell you about something happened to me." I was at Temple University yesterday, and afterwards we were having lunch, and an older physician, one of the gray eminences of the department, came up to me and said, "Let me tell you about something that happened to me, 50 years ago."
Wow.
And he said, "And it was the worst experience that I have ever had in my entire life."
Mm. Well, I think bad things do happen, and they stay with us. Thank you, Albert Wu, Dr. Wu. Linda Kenny is here, nodding away. It's always wonderful to see Linda nodding, like, I get what you're saying, and I've been there. Linda, tell us just very briefly about MITS. I think some people are familiar and perhaps others aren't. And then why you think it's so important to have the patient and the provider or a staff member sort of in this same frame or in a frame together.
MITS. Our mission is to support healing and restore hope to patients, families, and clinicians following adverse medical events. And we really don't get into the, you know, whether it was a medical error or whether it was an unanticipated outcome. We just get into the fact that care wasn't what it was expected and has an impact on both patients, families, and clinicians. The way I see it, I think the way we support folks needs to be done differently. However, I think we need to have support in place for both patients and families when these things happen. And the assumption out there, I think, is that now that we're disclosing and apologizing, that's okay, we've done it, we've supported them, when we haven't even really looked at the emotional impact short-term, long-term, and we have a little data on that. And then the clinicians, I really believe that any organization that, especially a hospital, they should be caring for their own caregivers. They should have infrastructures for support mechanisms. And I just wanted to add to what Albert said. I go and speak at Grand Rounds all the time, and it's always that older physician that you wouldn't think would open his mouth that will bare his soul about an incident that happened years ago. And, you know, sometimes I'm always amazed because I am not an insider in healthcare as far as I'm, quote, the patient. But these people are looking for somebody who's going to understand and talk to. You know, that many years carrying burdens and still wanting to talk to somebody, that gives you a clue right there. So I think there's starting to be, and Sue Scott can speak to the data, I think she's starting to collect it. There are other organizations starting to collect it, but there's still not enough to make an impact.
Okay.
Go ahead. Linda, just on your last thought, I don't know how many times after that conversation or before that conversation that very senior physician says, "And you know, I've never told anyone about this before."
I absolutely agree. There's been people, I have always said, don't you tell your wife? Don't you? Absolutely not. They don't tell a soul.
You know, the interesting disconnect there is, and we've learned this a lot through our IHI Open School with students in the health professions, the thing that scares them the most in their as they go through their training is that they're going to be involved in an incident and be isolated and will not begin to have anybody to talk to. And so it's fascinating kind of where we have to connect the dots. One more quick question, Linda, and then we will get to Susan Scott. You were part of MITS and others convened an interesting conference this past March, I think it was, March 2009. You produced a document out of there called What's Missing. That's a wonderful document. We have that in our resource document mm-hmm. that people will be able to get after the show today. Look for it. What would you say were perhaps the key things, though, that were missing? I realize there was quite a long list of what's missing, but maybe some of the top things.
I can give you some key points that we heard, but let me give people a background. If you go to the in case you don't go to the report, we did this in 2004 at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute when Jim Conway was the COO, and we sent out tons of invitations, and the only people we got to attend were the speakers, the physicians who had been part of my code team, my orthopedic surgeon, and, you know, some leaders in Dana-Farber and at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Unfortunately, you know, back then, nobody was really talking about it. That was 2004. They knew there was a problem, but that was about it. What ended up happening is we convened it again. We sent out invitations to all these institutions. This time, people responded. They came. So what I saw was people are interested. This is a topic that people know they have to do something about. So that was very important. And for me, that was it gave me hope that things are changing. Mm-hmm. So quickly, I'll run down some list that, you know, there's no one blanket thing that right. for clinicians that it takes different forms and it has to be hooked into different cultures. So there are different forms. So there's a peer support, and Sue Scott will talk about that. Kaiser uses an EAP that's connected with their employee assistance program. There's others that use psychological counseling. Children's Hospital in Boston does that. And we can't assume that everybody needs support, because there are those people for that moment won't need support. So we really have to make it make a menu of items that are available to everybody.
Right.
And then you need to pay close attention. This is one of the themes that came up for everybody. Pay close attention to those who have to do disclosure and apology, because that's probably a time when they need support more than ever, when they have to go have that difficult conversation after something goes wrong. But that was the gist of what we learned and what directions. But one of the key findings was that leadership has to be part of this mm-hmm. for this to this kind of support to be in place for both patients and families and clinicians.
Right, and leadership, it seems, at some level sort of sets the table and kind of gives the permission at some level. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. All right, Susan Scott, thank you for being patient. Do want to get you in here. Linda referred to data that you're starting to collect, and you're also now working on sort of a real on-the-ground type of program that can help work these various layers, this menu almost that Linda's referring to. Can you talk a little bit about your work and sort of what you're learning about what's needed sort of maybe in the immediate aftermath and then as things move along?
Okay, sure. Thanks, Madge.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't agree more with Linda and Albert and the participants describing their experiences. This really totally reflects the experiences we're having with our second victims here at the University of Missouri. Let me just give you a little background to help set the context. We've been working for about 4 years with second victims. Risk management and patient safety have joined together and have tried a unified approach to support our actively support our second victims and to identify exactly what their needs are. And Linda's absolutely right. Every clinician has very distinct, unique needs. And what we're finding is it's important for the institution to have a menu of selection so that whatever that clinician needs, we can have a fast-track resolution to meet that need. The clinicians, when you talk to them one-on-one, many of them do say, I've never shared this before to anyone. And there in itself is very therapeutic and very refreshing for them to know that there's somebody that they can turn to and just tell their story and just get it out in the open. And they're talking about...
Susan, do you want to just speak up just a little bit more?
Sure.
Yeah, it's great, great. All kinds of valuable stuff. I don't want people to miss it. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Sorry about that. The clinicians, as an immediate impact from the clinical events, they describe their experiences as the darkest hours of their clinical careers. And many go on to explain the emotional tsunami that has truly hit their personal and professional being and psyche. And so it's important that we have developed as institutions an emotional first aid response team that can address those needs. Many times we've found through our qualitative research that staff seem to kind of worry in a predictable manner. They worry, of course, first about the patient and if the patient's going to be okay. And then they worry about themselves, about their future roles as trusted, respected, and valued clinicians. And there's a true fear that they're going to compromise the loyalty of their comrades. And that's seen at every level, from a nursing tech up to a senior attending physician, all worries about the reputation that might be scarred. So what we need to do is we need to provide institutional awareness about what second victims are. It's easy to apply first aid, but if you don't have support throughout the healthcare industry, then that first aid is going to be for a second, and we have long-term care needs for the second victims.
So
one of the first things we need to do is to, and this is a perfect forum, Madge, to get the word out. What is a second victim? What does it look like? What are some high-risk clinical events that could expose a clinician to the second victim phenomenon? And then active surveillance so that everybody's on board to see, are you okay? And just ask each other if you're doing okay. That peer support is the number one thing that all of our research participants have said they wanted, is they wanted a colleague that could be there for them.
Do you have this system in place at your hospital?
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, we've been up for, we've had a pilot group in place from 05 to last March, and then last March we trained our first cohort of peers that is known as the For You team, and that was named by the team members themselves. You've cared for our patients, now it's time to care for you. And so it's a peer-to-peer support program that's available on a 24/7 pager availability. We can do different kinds of activations. We can do one-on-one coaching with or mentoring with an individual. Or we could also do teams. Many times teams are impacted by these events, and it's helpful to have team interventions and team debriefings. But it's also important to have in place a structure that you could do fast track for those maybe 10-15% of clinicians who are going to need additional support beyond what a trained peer facilitator can provide. So you need fast track options to chaplaincy. Many times these individuals are experiencing a spiritual crisis. To chaplaincy, to EAP, to clinical psychologist, to individuals who are trained and could provide a higher level of support than what the trained peers are able to afford.
Okay. Just one more question, and then Dr. Wu, I'm going to follow up with something to you. One of the things that I was struck by when Linda pointed out your work to me was that you do put a lot of emphasis, or at least make sure the light is also shined on what nurses need, and that in many instances nurses' needs can get kind of lost in the support equation, perhaps becoming, if I dare say this, almost third victims in this. Are the needs of doctors and nurses very different, and do they need to be addressed separately, together? How would you think about that?
Well, I think that really fully explore that, we'll need to do additional research projects. Mm-hmm. I can tell you with our sample of 31, it was close to half of them were physicians and half were nurses. We were not able to identify any distinct differences between their needs. You know, I think as human beings, we're all are experiencing this predictable, abnormal event, and we're responding in normal human ways. Mm. You know, sleepless nights, haunted reenactments, can't get it out of your mind, you know, maybe a fast pulse, maybe, I mean, all those signs of panic that everybody on the call knows what we're talking about, that's what those individuals sense. So need to make sure that they're aware that they even know what a second victim is. And sometimes just knowing what's going on with you at the time is very helpful. They've never experienced this before, so they don't know.
All right. Very, very helpful. I mean, some early data points, I think, that are very important. Excuse me. This is WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan, and that was just Susan Scott. Linda Kenny is here with me in the studio, and Dr. Albert Wu from Johns Hopkins is on the phone, and we're talking about second victims, how we can prevent further injuries to staff and patients following adverse events, bad outcomes. Dr. Wu, Albert Wu, in a sort of chicken and egg kind of thing, if your organization doesn't have a policy or it's really at its infancy about disclosure, apology, does this mean this is where you need to start first before you can do some of the things that Susan Scott is talking about? It seems to me some organizations, people might be waiting a long time for some help.
You
sorry,
know,
I mean, I didn't mean to sound too sarcastic, but I think
it can
be a while before all that gets worked out.
You know, anyone who practices, who does medicine, works in healthcare is going to be a little bit sarcastic or cynical at some point. But I actually just to say on the very last point before I get to that,
yeah.
I think nurses may actually be in some ways at greater risk than physicians because when bad things happen, and it's not always when it is exclusively your fault. People feel very badly, and nurses may in some cases, you know, be in the background or be perceived there and may not get as much attention, for better or worse, as the physicians who perhaps are designated to make the disclosure or handle the error. And nurses, because they deliver more care than anyone, are more likely to be subjected to repeated incidents. Mm. And I've heard one nurse say that sort of going back to work after a particularly horrible outcome for a patient was like going back to a war zone. Mm. And I think the analogy to PTSD becomes much more clear with that sort of statement. You know, organizations and individuals to do, I think the key is that we cannot wait until it all gets worked out and then we can start. I think that this has to be both top-down, leadership is important, and policies and expectations need to be set, and structures need to be put in place. But I think this needs to be bottom-up, too. And maybe the single most important thing that we can do right this second is to ourselves be aware and to help our colleagues be aware that this is a universal problem and that we can be part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now we are very ambivalent about medical errors in general, and we're very uncomfortable about how to handle our colleagues when these things happen. And there almost seems to be a, you know, sort of don't ask, don't tell sort of approach to this. Perhaps if we just ignore it, it will go away.
Yeah.
And what I think we have to realize is that when one of the consequences of these things happening is that, you know, as Linda was mentioning, that people, when these things happen, whether an adverse event happens to a patient or whether a healthcare worker is party to an adverse event, you feel a tremendous sense of isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're the only one who's ever experienced anything like this. You're alone with your worst fears realized, and at that moment, it's a very, very lonely and scary place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that peers can help with.
Right.
And simply by saying, you know, I know what this is like. This happens to all of us. And perhaps even sharing an incident, a personal incident, is can be extremely comforting.
Okay. Well, I have a zillion more questions for each of you, and I've got them sort of in my back pocket. It's about 2:30, though. We're at the half-hour mark, and as promised, I really want to get those of you who have joined us. I think Melissa already has gotten a comment in there. So Jesse McCall is going to remind everybody how you can chat in your questions and comments. I'm Madge Kaplan, and you're tuned to WIHI, and you were just listening to Dr. Albert Wu, and Linda Kenny is with me, and Susan Scott as well. So, Jesse.
Thanks a lot, Madge. So, we are going to open the chat room now for everyone, and when you're chatting, you can select who you're going to send it to with that drop-down menu. We ask that you select all participants so that everyone's able to see your comments and insights. When you select all participants, you can enter your comment or question in the text box below that and hit send. And as I have on previous programs, one came in ahead of time that I'm going to jump in with because I think it's a really good one. Do you maintain confidentiality if the second victim requests it? How do you handle a situation when an adverse event has occurred but the second victim hasn't reported it? Do you have the obligation to report it? And does the second victim know that you're going to do that ahead of time? How do you handle a tough situation like that?
Thanks, Jesse. That's an interesting point, and that could be, I was just thinking before, that could be even somebody noting a near miss of something. Let's just jump right in. Maybe, Susan, since you're sort of on the ground with doing some work with this, talk a little bit about confidentiality.
Okay. When we work with the peers, they all realize that there's a strong element of confidentiality, and any breach of confidentiality leads to dismissal from our peer team. So up front, everyone understands how serious that is, and we reinforce it constantly. But when we're actually working one-on-one with the second victims, we need to figure out, you know, where they're at and what we need to do for them first. And many times it is truly just their minds are real scrambled with disorganized thought, and they need help with just a processing piece of it. So what we do is we call it defusing. It's a critical incident stress management technique. We work with them one-on-one just to try to get them to calm down, to talk about what they're thinking. And not so much about the actual event itself as in an investigation, but just how it's impacting them. And then once we've got them kind of calmed down. So it's almost like an emotional first aid response team, almost mm-hmm. like a rapid response team for personnel that could go in and talk to them. Some things have to be reported, and we will protect their anonymity as best we can. And we're very, very delicate about that. And we just have a very few key leaders who actually, you know, are actually kind of the gatekeepers. We'll de-identify cases as best we can. Sometimes we can't do that. Sometimes, and we explain to them, and we work with the second victim so that they realize that we're not trying to blame anyone. We're trying to move that culture forward, but that still is a very harsh culture out there, and everybody is so terrified of medical legal risk, of losing their licensure, their livelihood, and there's this still a veil of secrecy. They're been told for years, don't talk about anything when something bad happens. And what we need to do is kind of flip that upside down, and we need to get them to realize that if we talk about it, we can get lessons learned, and we can get messages out to their colleagues that maybe they won't fall into the same error path that they themselves have as second victims. So we try to work with them. We do not share the names of any of our second victims. It's very confidential service, and we do promote that as best we can.
Thank you. Linda, yeah.
I just want to add, we had an attorney at that forum that we had last March, and one of the key points that he made was, you know, when you're collecting information like that, lessons learned, that usually is done in a protected environment. There's protections for that. However, you know, it takes a real skill set to have a person really stay on track, talk about your feelings versus. So it does take a skilled peer or leader to be able to do that, because there are appropriate times that you want to just you know, be talking about your feelings. I really believe people should get the help, but they need to protect themselves too. Susan's program sounds great, but there are still places where there isn't protection like that in place. So really be careful. You can talk about your feelings, and that can't be used in court at any time. But when you start talking about some of the facts of the case, that's where you get in trouble if you're not in a protected environment.
Okay. There is actually and has been a question about that, the legal ramifications. If you are the recipient of information, could you in some sense kind of wind up being deposed or that kind of thing? So,
I could clarify that,
yeah,
Madge,
yep,
with our For You team.
Yep.
So the goal of our team is to address the emotional needs that the staff members and the clinicians have. So whenever we have an event, the investigator is not the same as the supporter. So we have a supporter that goes in and provides emotional first aid to the clinician, and then a different person is the investigator. So we don't keep any written notes about our talk. We just kind of talk about this is what you could expect as a second victim and kind of define that. But there's really nothing that would be discoverable that we maintain as far as our records go. Ours is purely focused on the response and the reaction of the clinician to the abnormal event.
Okay. Dr. Wu, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, I think that Susan and Linda and the programs that they have established are really sort of out in front on this, but two thoughts. One is that we, in fact, really do not know what the best approach and the best system is yet to handle these situations.
Right.
So this is still early days, this is an opportunity for all of us. I'm learning as we're talking, but I hope that the folks who are on the line also will go out, and there's still plenty of time to pioneer approaches. At Johns Hopkins, we are just confronting this now, and we're trying to set up a team in many ways similar to what Susan and Linda have put together. I think that it's clear to us that it is better if it's not piecemeal.
Yep.
If in fact you have a mechanism for, if you have a policy, a standard operating procedure for how things get handled, then you can tell people, yes, your confidentiality will be protected. Yes, this information is protected. The counselors who talk to you, their sole job is to take care of you, and there's other things that we'll be doing to do all of the other things that we need to handle the whole incident. One way to do that would be, to get a little bit piecemeal, is if incidents come in via risk management, so the mechanism by which the institution becomes aware of the incident and that activates the crisis team, is if it comes in through risk management, then in fact information, a file can be created and the information can be protected, but it really needs to be thought through.
Okay. Go ahead, Linda. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, Dr. Wu, you keep bringing up that the people on this call, can go out and do something today, and I think you're absolutely right. So one of the things that I try to tell people, I want to get to the questions, but, sometimes there's informal supports that are already in our organizations, and we don't even know it. Sometimes, if you're in an anesthesia department, they might have a contract with the psychiatry department. I mean, do an internal
scan
and find out what's in there. They have social work that do this. There are already supports in place. And then what I would find out, too, is an external scan. What's out there? There are physicians' health services in states that have this peer support mechanism. But there are things in place that we might want to pull together some of these people and say, how can we formalize this? And I think you're right, Dr. Wu. It has to be anchored into some place that's going to support the infrastructure.
All right.
That is such an important point, too, though. There are, in fact, lots of resources. There are wise people, senior nurses and senior doctors who people go to for support. I think those people are being underexploited not utilized systematically. Healthcare workers are notoriously poor at availing themselves of counseling and other help, even though there are assistance programs in place in every, you know, every institution, virtually no one uses them.
I'm struck. Thank you. I'm struck by Randolph Peto. I love your idea here in the chat. He says, I wonder if we should set up a national repository where clinicians could submit medical errors from their past and then have those stories de-identified. Maybe this could help in some way unburden those clinicians and demonstrate the large number of stories that are out there. There was Lori Zipperer, I think, in the chat here also mentioned something using social networking tools.
Right.
So I guess Randy,
yeah. Randy and Lori, I know both those people. You know what you can do? You can submit them to the MITS Facebook, and we'll start to collect those stories.
Okay. I mean, one of the things I'm hearing, there's, first of all, thank you all. A lot of good questions, many more than we're going to get to today. But don't forget, you can download the chat, keep the discussion going. One of the things that I'm hearing, though, apart from, you know, waiting for the perfect system, also trying to figure out or not waiting for the perfect system and waiting for and using some of this, the levers that are out there right now, and Linda's pointing to something, but I'm going to get it in just a second, is the sort of the ability, I suppose, to – it's almost as though somebody's waiting for some permission from somebody. In other words, and I'm curious about that in terms of Susan Scott, and you people were saying kind of leadership is needed almost to start to give some permission here. So whose responsibility might that be? If it's a culture change, it's a system change, it's really kind of the scan. And by the way, MITS has some interesting tools that can do some scanning, which we've also got on our document after the call. Is there somebody or some office in an organization that in some sense says, we're going to, you know, sort of turns on the light and says, we're going to deal with this?
You know, Madge, it seems like each organization is so distinct. So it's really hard to say that this group should own it or this group should own it. In our case, what we did was we found a local champion that had a passion for the topic and worked from that level forward. Now, that local champion, if they're at like middle management or below, will need to have a senior champion in the executive suite to sponsor it. But if you just start talking about what a second victim is, chances are that senior executive also has a story to tell if they're in the clinical field, if they come from a clinical field. So it truly isn't hard to get the executive leaders on board with this. I mean, if you just start telling your story, everybody can relate to it. Mm-hmm. And there's a passion that's associated with that that helps kind of drive that forward. So what it's going to have to take is each institution's just going to have to figure out and kind of look inside who would be the best fit. It might be the leader of the social workers. Mm-hmm. It might be a chaplain. I've been contacted by lots of chaplains who are coordinating little local efforts. It could be an EAP program brought into the hospital in the form of a professional office of professional support. I mean, it really runs the gamut from a volunteer chaplain for a real small hospital to the CQO of a larger facility. Yeah. So it all depends on your internal culture.
Okay. I'm curious, Dr. Wu, we have some 30-odd states and kind of counting that have been working on various forms of sort of sorry, in some sense giving some protection around the issue of apology. And we were talking before about what kinds of things, you know, can be, you know, legally protected, et cetera, in terms of conversations. Do we have any understanding at all about whether the existence of some of those laws or new rules in a statewide way or wherever they're being instituted, that they are in any way sort of helping with the almost some of the micro changes we're talking about here?
You know, I think that they are, I think they're helping some. Though at the same time, people in some states are waiting, are holding their breath for their state to pass an apology shield before they're willing to apologize. Pennsylvania is an example where there, in fact, is no apology shield. And physicians that I spoke to yesterday said that many people are reluctant to apologize, and they will not do so. They'll say, I'm sorry, but not, we're sorry that we did this, because that theoretically is not protected. And I think that people are confusing all conversations with legal conversations, when in fact a lot of what we're talking about is either conversations which are therapeutic between patients, families, and physicians and nurses, or conversations between peers, which are not going to get outside of the organizations. So I do think that there's a lot of confusion, and the idea that we need apology laws is, I think, maybe just reflects a trend that we are maturing and appreciating, that it would be nice if policy helped encourage people to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Linda?
I just want to say, I think if we start, acknowledging the clinician, it's funny, you would think being a patient that I would say, what are you doing for the patients? I do say that. However, if we start acknowledging that, clinicians are human and that they need support, especially when they're exposed to this, these devastating events, I think if we start to acknowledge that, we will then see that they will see, what the patient might need in that. But I wanted to say, this second victim topic is getting such attention that CRICO RMF, they insure all the Harvard institutions, and they are creating a film on second victims.
Uh-huh.
I think Johns Hopkins is in it, Sue Scott, Kaiser, Brigham and Women's, but they're highlighting second victims, and not just physicians, it's nurses, physicians, anybody on the staff that's affected. So this is wonderful. People are finally bringing light. I think more of that happens.
There was something.
We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah. I just missed that. No, Bill Powers.
Okay, that's great. By the way, there was somebody who also typed in that in terms of this national repository idea, that patient safety organizations, if you get certified as that or identified as that under the federal law, that you have some protection there in terms of if information is collected. Again, I think people realize that you can submit information about medical errors, I think, as a means people are trying to get a better sense of what's going on, and that also offers some protection. I want to just also address, a lot of people are still wondering about some of the cultural issues, shame and blame, and why that persists. I think we could have a whole program on that unto itself. But does anybody want to take a stab at that? Susan? You can think about it.
That's a tough one.
It is a tough one, and I invite everyone who's with us today to go ahead and bring that in. In some sense, we've been talking about human nature. I think all the fears that go on, and we're trying to turn around certain ways that we've gone about things. Dr. Wu, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that this is a difficult topic, but I think that a lot of one of the reasons why shame and blame is so difficult to root out is that a lot of it is internalized.
Correct.
And when we make errors, we are deeply ashamed and blame ourselves. And when other people do things, on the one hand, we sort of say, there but for the grace go I.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think that by acknowledging that it is possible, you're acknowledging that you yourself may be fallible. And I've seen people sort of visibly, instead of comforting someone, steel themselves and, sort of draw themselves up and say, well, you shouldn't have done that, or something that is some message that maybe a parent said or a parental administrator said at some point early on in your career. It's almost like people can't bear to confront it, and so they mouth all of this sort of shame and blame, which is very deeply dug into our culture.
The individual second victims, actually, one of the first things that they do after the event is identified is what we refer to as self-isolation, and that's where the shame and the blame really escalates very, very, very quickly. And they're blaming themselves. They're harsher on themselves than probably any of their colleagues would be, and is trying to get to that to help them understand that might not be the case.
Which
now,
is
that, with that said, later on, like after the healings happened, like a day or two or three settled, all of the clinicians would really like the opportunity to sit down with the peer and have an honest reflection on the care that that patient received and what could be done the next time. And in doing that in a kind of peer and a mentoring kind of coaching way, we can slowly chip away at the shame and blame that's from the external environment to the second victim. And I think that would be really helpful as well.
Okay. Dr. Wu, did you want to say something?
Oh, I was agreeing so vociferously with what you were saying. But, I think that it is very comforting. It's surprisingly comforting to hear someone else say, oh, yeah, that happened to me.
Right.
The other day, we did a panel with our second-year medical students, and five physicians volunteered to sit up and talk about errors they had made. And it started out, there was sort of one of these audience response devices, and the students were asked, how many of you think you'll make a mistake? You know, sort of half raised their hands, or three-quarters. How many of you think you'll make a mistake that will hurt a patient? Maybe half of the hands went up. How many think you will make an error that will kill a patient or lead to a patient's death, contribute to a patient's death? You know, maybe 10%. And then the same questions were asked to the panelists, and the hands went up for the first question. They stayed up for the second question. They all stayed up for the third question. And someone in the audience said, oh, shit. And each of the physicians then told a story, and it was remarkable. These were things often from dozens of years ago, and two of them cried during their presentations, and it was very therapeutic for the panelists. We got a lot out of it. I'm not sure if the medical students did, but we thought it was terrific.
Yeah, well, from what we know and what we've experienced even with the Open School, I think, would the future doctors and nurses and others get a lot out of this. I guess part of what we're trying to figure out, though, here in this program today, and I didn't think we were going to nail it and solve it, although we've got pieces of what's some solutions here, is kind of in that very charged immediate situation, sort of. That's a very critical period. It's almost like a window of when feelings are at their most intense and when I think the interventions would make often the most difference. So I think part of when you're describing what you are, Dr. Wu, you know, it's partly people have gotten a lot of distance and reflection and sort of then become, you know, more articulate. And I guess what we're trying to figure out is how we can make that more present at the time. Just very quickly, I do want to mention that we just one interesting program coming up at IHI, Achieving Clinical Integration Through Highly Engaged Physicians. That's happening in Cambridge, Mass. On the 25th and 26th of March. Jim Reinertsen and Alice Gosfeld, familiar to many people, IHI faculty members, they'll be on point and talking about improving physician engagement and quality and safety initiatives. More information on our website. All right, we're going to start to wrap up, and I think I'm just going to go around the horn here. I'm going to ask... I'll start with Susan Scott. You had a lot of concrete ideas, so people are going to jump off this program today and say, that was interesting, and then they got to go back to work and whatever they're doing. Thinking just sort of on the ground, what could people start to do almost regardless of where they are in the organization?
Well, immediately they could start integrating the second victim concept into their work practices that they do every day. So, like if they're called into a code blue, they could, at the very end, they could debrief and see, surveil themselves if there's any second victims that perhaps they could personally impact. The idea of making sure people are okay and asking about if they need any kind of help. Sometimes just saying, are you okay, opens the door for these clinicians. And then also kind of consider as an institutional perspective what are going to be your long-term support for those individuals who need a little more support than a peer can provide.
Okay. All right. Very good. Dr. Wu?
You know, I think that the one thing that we can do is to just sort of think that, keep in mind that a little kindness goes a long way. And if we are all a little bit kinder to each other, the whole this enterprise, which can sometimes be very perilous, might be just a little bit easier. And the second thing, sort of a corollary to that, is to think twice before you berate or criticize someone when you see something happen. It's even though it's a natural inclination. I'd say for people who are running organizations, to begin thinking about what can be done from the top down, including establishing policies, standard procedures, and then letting people know that this is what the boss thinks about this, and if you're waiting for permission, this is that permission, and this is how we're going to handle it going forward.
Okay. Linda, I would imagine that patients and families, as part of the ongoing process of improving all the ways that we're responding to them as well, are in some sense counting on health professionals to begin to figure this out for staff as well.
Oh, absolutely. And ironically, is staff assume that patients and families are being their needs are being met emotionally, mm-hmm. and patients and families assume that clinicians' needs are being met. It's really ironic. They're both on opposite ends, and neither one of them are getting their needs met. Mm-hmm. But I loved what all the speakers had to say, and I just want to say I think you're right. You know. People often say to me, how could I forgive? You can just go to MITS.org to see my story, but if you don't know it. But people always say, how could I forgive, Dr. Van Pelton? It wasn't even about that. You know, I took 1 minute to put myself in his place to think, how would I feel if that was happening to me? If I was the one holding the needle that day and almost killed somebody, how would I feel? It goes back to what Dr. Wu said. We have to just take a moment before we walk away from a colleague or get away because we feel uncomfortable. How would you want to be treated? You know, what would you want from a colleague? If we just ask that question to ourselves, I think we could do a better job. And find out in your organization who the change agents are that can make things happen.
All right. Well, part of what we heard today is that there are many change agents, and there's not only one path here, but there are a lot of really good ideas. And I'm very, very grateful to Linda Kenny, who's here with me, Susan Scott, Dr. Albert Wu on the phone. Thank you so much for your time, your leadership. I think everyone has benefited from each of you today. Thank you, our participants. You asked a lot of good questions, chatted in a lot of really good ideas. Thank you. We'll try and keep that going. By tomorrow, we'll have an audio download of this program available on our website. You can also find it on iTunes. You can look under the archive tab on WIHI for more information. Again, we have a nice resource document, all kinds of things that were mentioned today. Also, the organizations will get that up. That's all available on the RCAP page as well by tomorrow. Definitely download the chat when you log off. And if you don't mind, we always appreciate your feedback. How did we do with this program today? Lots of stuff. We can never get to it all, but we'd love your feedback. And if you have any ideas or suggestions for programs, please email us at info@ihi.org. On February 18th, that's 2 weeks from today, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, former FDA Commissioner Dr. David Kessler is going to be on board, as well as two leaders from the National Initiative for Children's Healthcare Quality. We're talking about obesity and what foods high in salt, sugar, and fat have to do with it. The good news, though, is that we can figure out what to do about that as well. Information about that is now available on our website. We hope you'll join us. The people who make this program possible, and they are many, Jonathan Small, Mike Sweeney, Brittany McPhee, Jesse McCall, Alan Olison, Jane Rossner, and Vicki Minden. I thank them. The musical selections that you hear just before WIHI begins, performed and arranged by Patricio and Jennifer Batayas, and the music that we use to open and close the program, original arrangements by Aaron Flanders on guitar and Miguel Sapasoa on piano. I want to, again, thank everyone for your time, your ideas, your commitment today. It is my privilege to host a program that's about spirited learning and improving patient care, most of all, for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I'm Madge Kaplan. Good day, everyone.